From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Pat Conroy's penchant for writing semi-autobiographical novels has gotten him into trouble with his family. His novel, The Great Santini, was about an abusive father. When Conroy's father read it, he threw the book across the room and cursed it. When Conroy wrote The Prince of Tides, based in part on his sister's suicide attempt, she begged him not to write about her. Conroy's new novel, Beach Music, was inspired by the death of his mother, who he says constantly lied about the family history till it sounded good. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Conroy about his family and the books they've inspired. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews a new recording of a 1963 concert that helped reestablish Bukka White as one of the great Delta bluesmen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pat Conroy's best-known novels have been based on his family. The Great Santini was inspired by his father, a Marine fighter pilot who was a strict disciplinarian at home and would use his fist to keep everyone in line. The film adaptation starred Robert Duvall as the father. In Conroy's novel The Prince of Tides, the story is set in motion after the main character's sister tries to commit suicide, as Conroy's sister had tried to do. Barbra Streisand directed the film adaptation of The Prince of Tides and starred as the sister's psychotherapist who ends up teaching the brother about himself. Conroy has a new novel called Beach Music. It's the story of a middle-aged man trying to get away from his past after his wife's suicide, but he has to return home to face his mother's death. Pat Conroy says the impulse to write the novel came after his mother died.
My mother died when she was 59. Still beautiful, still lovely. It surprised her seven children very much because she seemed indestructible. It was the one person in the family we thought would never die, had that aura of a goddess about her from the time we were little children. And her death was excruciating. It took a long time. It was leukemia. And it was the one thing that was like the whole family being thunderstruck at the same time. And I knew even while I was going through it that, you know, I was dealing with one of those times that, for a writer, changed the world forever. And anytime anything changes my world, I end up writing about it.
What year was it?
1984.
Let me ask you to read a portion from Beach Music about the mother who is dying of leukemia. And this is a hospital scene in which the main character and members of the family have come to the hospital to be with her.
No one loved theater or spectacle more than my mother. But this coming together contained no aspects of whim, and it was not a joke. She had taught her sons to laugh, but not to grieve. And so, with nothing to do, we sat around and waited, trying to learn the laws and courtesies of dying. Under such extreme pressure, we got to know each other again. We had come to a meeting place in our lives that would be a part summing up and a part winking to the gods of darkness.
It's Pat Conroy reading an excerpt of his new novel, Beach Music. Did she suspect that you'd be writing about her death, and what do you think she made
See,
of
my
that?
Family now, Terry, fully expects to have their entire life written about by me. This is not, I cannot surprise anyone any longer. My mother certainly, I mean, my mother did soliloquies on her deathbed. My mother did fabulous remembrances of things of her girlhood. She changed things. She lied. All the time knowing that her Boswell sat there worshipfully by her bed, remembering every word. So this has become part of the weirdness of the family dynamic now, is everyone thinks I can write it down, I can change it, I can use it in a book, and that they will appear in a movie.
In the novel Beach Music, the family reads to the mother as she's dying. Did you do that with your mother?
My sister and I did. What we did with Mom is they told us when she went into the coma, the last coma, and the doctor said she will be dead. You know, we can't tell you what the time length will be, but she's dying now. And said people that have come back from this said when they're in the coma, they could still hear. So Carol and I started reading Mom's favorite poetry to her. and we got a book of her poems, and we began reading, and we would take turns reading. And what I think we wanted is, my mother had a beautiful reading voice, and she read to us, "When I think of my childhood, I think of my mother reading books to me. And I think of that hour or two before bedtime when my mother would read, and I think my sister becoming a poet, my becoming a novelist, that my mother's voice was connected to all this." So we wanted, our idea was, we would send our mother out on this great loving wave of the English language she had taught us to love.
Did you have any feeling whether it was reaching her?
You know, I the poetry we read was so beautiful, it was calming to me.
Right.
And I thought if my mother could hear it, that this was the last gift we were giving her.
Were those your last words, the poems?
Yeah, those were it. That was the last thing she heard. You know, plus, I had this too. My brothers and I would go in and we would say this. That was a lie. My brothers would go in and say, "Mom, it's me, Mike. I loved you the best. Pat didn't care. Pat's not even here at the hospital. It's me, Mike, all alone."
You're so, goofing around like that?
Yeah. I mean, my brothers, this is my brother's way. They would do that. And, "Mom, it's me, Tim. I loved you. Jim is here, Mom. The only one that cared." And it was, and my brothers, they're funny guys, and they kept it up. I mean, they did not break stride, even on the deathbed.
My guest is Pat Conroy. He's the author of The Prince of Tides and The Great Santini. His new novel just published is called Beach Music. Your novel begins after the suicide of the main character's wife. And so after her suicide, he leaves Charleston with his young daughter and goes to Rome. I mean, his goal is amnesia. He says, "My quest was amnesia, but no one walks out of his family without reprisals. A family is too disciplined an army to offer compassion to its deserters." I think in a way that's a kind of theme of your work, you know, the desire to cut ties with family and the strength of those ties.
Yeah, I went to Italy with my family in 1981, and there was great relief in this for me. There was this great thing that my family could not get to me, nor did they understand why I went. One of my brothers couldn't understand how he could go anywhere where I wouldn't hear the result of the Darlington 500. And I had a sister who said, "Well, Pat, you're going to Italy?" And I said, "Yeah." Kathy said, "I've never liked foreigners." And I said, "Well, why not?" And she said, "Because they're foreign. They're different." So it was an odd thing to do. But what I did not realize when I went to Rome, as I was writing The Prince of Tides at that time, is that all memory would follow me there and become clearer and sharper when I was on foreign soil. And when I started writing about the Low Country of South Carolina there, I could see it and smell it in a way I never could when I was actually living there.
So what brought you back to the States?
My mother's death. I got a phone call from my brother Mike over there. And this hit a hideous part of the family dynamic. And I put this, I'm not sure Nantelis did not cut this out when she edited, but when my brother Mike called me up and said my mother was dying, I laughed, okay. And I sound like a terrible person, but I roared laughing. And my brother Mike said, "Everybody did this, Pat. Don't worry about it." And I said, "What is she dying of?" And he said, "I won't tell you." I said, "You're telling me I'm not even going to think about coming." She said, "She's dying of leukemia." With this, I hit the floor laughing. It was for this reason, Terry, in the odd family I came out of. My mother had once thought she was losing control of her children. We were sassing her. Dad was overseas in Vietnam. And one of the kids had accused my mother of having an affair with a priest. And she gathered the seven children together. And, you know, Dad was overseas. And I think the girls had accused her of having this affair with this priest, who I think was a good friend. I have no idea if they had an affair or not. But she gathered us together because she was meeting the priest in Washington, D.C. the next weekend. Okay, it looks suspicious. But my mother, as she gathered us, said she was going to Bethesda Naval Hospital because she had leukemia, and she would be dead within 2 weeks. Okay, with this was a great way to diffuse the tension over the possibility of an affair. So, because we wept, we cried, we grabbed her ankles, we let her walk around the room with us. I mean, the whole family just fell apart. And a month later, I was riding with my brother Mike somewhere, and he broke down in tears. I said, "What's wrong, Mike?" And he said, "Why isn't she dead?" And I said, I don't know. And my mother not only brought it up that she died of leukemia, she dropped it. I mean, we never heard of it again. We just were grateful that the gods had let her live. Now, this was one of the primal scenes of all of our lives. And when my brother Mike then called 15 years later and said, Mom was dying, and every one of the kids had the reaction. First of all, there's a tremendous laughter. We roared laughing. Then when he said, she's dying of leukemia, we said, even God does not have that good a sense of humor. This is impossible. And so this became one of the reasons I mean, it seems so dreadful, it's so unlikely that God had been listening to my mother on that day. And then it just seemed like too much. Even for my family, it seemed like too much there.
Well, in your novel, when Jack gets the call that his mother has cancer, I mean, his reaction is, oh, she says she has cancer. She's really just acting out.
Well, my mother always, I mean, she would use her death as a way of getting us to clean up our rooms. You know, I have never seen anybody as shameless as my mother in doing this. And when I say she was theatrical, I mean, she could convince you, I will be dead. I'll never forget this. I will be dead in 2 weeks. Her seven children sprawled out weeping. We didn't know, Mom. I didn't want to tell you. I thought it would upset you. It does upset us, Mom. You know, you're dying.
So you came back to the States when you found out that your mother truly was sick.
And I said, Mike, if you are not serious, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to beat you up. I mean, I said, I am going to fly back from Italy because she's pulling this again. Is she dating a priest? What's going on? And he said, Pat, I'm telling you, I've been in to see her. She may be dead by the time you get here. And with those words, then Mike started crying. I said, Mike, I've never seen you cry in my life. And so I was on the next plane from Rome the next day. And Mom indeed was. And she had begun the process of dying. And she was in a coma when I got back.
My guest is Pat Conroy, author of the novels The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, and the new book Beach Music. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Pat Conroy. He has a new novel called Beach Music. I'm sure a lot of your readers feel like they know your father because he was the bassist of The Great Santini. Is your father still alive?
As my brothers say, unfortunately. No. Yeah, Dad is. That's Dad is, you know, he will listen to this. And he called me up yesterday. He said, did you catch me on TV? And I said, Dad, unfortunately. He said, I was magnificent, son. He said, anytime you and I are together, America can see the two ways America have gone, the weak-kneed, liberal way that you have gone, and the stuff that has made our nation great, the way I have gone.
Now, do you both laugh when he says that?
Dad is very funny. When we were being photographed together for Vanity Fair, uh-huh. And it was, I didn't want to wear these hats. They made us wear these white hats. Because I'm a Southerner, they put me in this white hat, okay? I said, Dad, I don't want to wear this hat. We're wearing them, son. I said, why? He said, they're going to give me the hat, son. They dress us in these suspenders that came from some designer store. I said, Dad, you know, these suspenders, we're not wearing these. He said, we're wearing them all, son. They're giving me all the suspenders, son, 10 pair, $1,000. So my father got in it, and when we were getting the pictures taken, Terry, we had this pose, and so we're face to face. And I said, Dad, let me ask you a question. What was it like to beat me up when I was a baby? He said, without hesitation, I enjoyed it, son. It was great exercise. Aerobics. And we were sitting there facing the camera. But my father is fast. He is quick. And he has made a shtick out of this. Dad goes on radio programs like this in down south giving advice on child rearing.
You're kidding.
And he's become this Nazi Dr. Spock. And what he says is America needs more discipline. And, this is, I have to appreciate this because and what I have to do is, you know, since I wrote about Dad, exposed Dad, I have to let him come back. And he does it very well.
So do you see your role as being the forgiving son at some point?
Yeah, I have I told Dad, I said, Dad, I cannot be mad at you any longer for things you did to me 45 years ago. It is, there has to be some forgiveness now. And he said, I never touched your son. So I said, that's when I get irritated again. And
when he completely denies it.
Yeah, when he just denies it. I think he just denies it now just to irritate me and get, you know, make me mad.
So does he have a completely different version of your childhood
yes.
and his fatherhood than
Here
you do?
Here is his version. It was there was an article in Atlanta Magazine several years ago, and it said, the great Santini talks back. In this, I sounded like a member of the Von Trapp family. That we, what we did, we sang in choirs, and we collected money for lepers. And, and Dad was this, benevolent Mother Teresa figure, who just a wonderful, fabulous man, who simply adored his children and knitted booties for us when we were infants. And, you know, I read this. I called Dad. I said, Dad, and you call me a fiction writer? What is it? What is this nonsense? I didn't even recognize the guy. But Dad said, all's fair, love and war, son. He said, didn't I look great in the picture? And my father's become enamored with his own image in the media. And he's now putting his own spin on it.
Pat Conroy is my guest. He's the author of The Prince of Tides and The Great Santini and a new novel called Beach Music. I believe it was in the final stages of Beach Music that one of your brothers committed suicide. Was he schizophrenic?
Yes. He was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic about the time. He had his first break when Mom was dying. And he's the youngest kid, my baby brother. And it was, I had him as a character in the book. I wrote about my brothers in this book. And the character John Harden was based on my brother Tom. And where the writing of the book took a dreadful turn for me was when I got the call from Mike again. Mike makes these calls in the family, saying that Tom had leapt from a 14-story building in Columbia, South Carolina. And we had to bury him very quickly because Tom was what they call a disaster body, and they could not embalm him. And so we had to gather as fast as we could because it was summer in South Carolina. And when I called Nan Talese, my editor, I said, Nan, I've already killed Tom in this book. I had Tom commit suicide in the book in one of the last chapters. And I said, I got to change that now. And Nan was great. She said, whatever you do, it'll be fine. And so I did. I have, you know, John Harden is still walking around when this book, Beach Music, is over.
Did your brother know that the character based on him committed suicide in your novel?
You know, no. He kind of knew because the last time I saw Tom is he sort of indicated he knew that he was in this book and couldn't wait to read about it. So I had worried a great deal about what he would think about my having that character kill himself, and I'd come up with rationalizations. You know, the novel needed it. It had to happen. This was a plot. Is it, you know, worked itself out? And it had been a great worry of mine that I then no longer had to worry about. But what I could not do was I didn't think the book Beach Music could bear the weight of sadness of his suicide in it after he had done it.
From what I've read, it sounds like this was a really difficult book for you. I mean, there was your brother's suicide, and then it took, I think, a long time for you to write. And I think you had a nervous breakdown along the way while writing it.
Yes, I frequently do. I have those a while.
What does that mean, by the way?
I don't know.
Breakdown, and I never know exactly what they mean when they say that.
I never knew either. I don't even know what to call it. It's I generally have one about, you know, one every book.
I don't, excuse me for laughing.
That's okay.
That's all right, Terry.
That's been about my average. And it generally comes at some time where life overwhelms me. Depression has always been something that I have been, it's a familiar territory to me. It's a country I know well. And usually during the writing of this book, I find something out that I did not know before. In this book, I found out something that just devastated me as I was, you know, writing about Mom, writing about, you know, these brothers. Is it seemed to me that one of the things that has always confused me in my life is I've had trouble loving people. And then when I was writing this book, it occurred to me that you have to be taught how to love. and that my parents were not taught how to do it. I was not taught how to do it, and it overwhelmed me that I taught not taught my children how to do it. And when I told people this, they said, "Oh, everybody knows how to love. You just do it." And I didn't think so. I thought it was something, you know, that could be learned, that could be, you know, taught to people, that could be taught to kids, and that if you weren't taught that and you wanted to throughout life not knowing how to do it, that this was a devastating realization for me, not only as a writer, but as a human being. And what it is, I started, you know, getting depressed in this. The depression led to more and more drinking. The drinking led to more and more depression. And, you know, when I say breakdown, it was, and where it always leads to me is that the dream of suicide becomes lovely to me during those times. And that's what I, you know, what I mean by a nervous breakdown, that it always reaches a point where I, you know, think about, you know, killing myself.
Did you check yourself into a hospital when you
were
there?
What I did is, there was a shrink, Marion O'Neill, that I'd had in Atlanta. I realized she had, and by the way, here's what I worried about too, Terry. When I walk into a shrink's office in the United States and say, "Hi, I wrote The Prince of Tides. You want to be in a movie?" You know, it's not like anybody else walking
exactly
into a shrink's office. And I could not figure out how to do this and get the help I needed. And Marion had been a shrink of mine in Atlanta in the 70s. And so I realized she'd moved to Hilton Head. So I called Marion up and I said, "Marion, I need you again, kid." And Marion said, "You did not do all the work that you were supposed to do. You quit too soon, Pat." She said, "Come on over." So what I did is I started going over to Hilton Head from Fripp Island every day. And I think Marion saved my life.
Can I say something that's going to sound really perverse?
I love perverse.
well, here you go. When I read, you know, that you'd had this breakdown, part of me thought, well, in some really perverse way, this is a good sign in the sense that, you know, you've taken so much from your life and made it into fiction, and you're such a good storyteller that, you know, there's always this fear that someone is going to become so proficient at telling the story of their life that they're going to stop feeling what the stories are, you know, stop feeling the real life.
Yeah.
And
I certainly hope that happens to me. I really would adore that.
You'd like that.
I was hoping that's what therapy would do for me.
Anyways, but I figured, well, you know, you're definitely still feeling things pretty strongly there.
Yeah, I can't help them. I was born, and I said, "Dad, it is a living miracle. I came from your loins, from your warlike sperm cells. I cannot, whatever happened here simply is a miracle that I came from the loins of Zeus." And Dad always says, "It was your mother's son. It ruined you." But, you know, it is. It is something that I've felt things deeply. And you know, when I was a kid, I would feel this way and think everybody else felt the same way. And it was a surprise to me to realize, you know, you could cut yourself off from these feelings.
But some people just did it naturally. They didn't even have to try.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to be much of a relief for me to feel. And I think that is what, I think it is the impulse of the artist, that life passes through you, that life lives in your blood cells, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Pat Conroy, his new novel is called Beach Music. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with novelist Pat Conroy, author of The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, and the new novel, Beach Music. We'll talk about the role psychotherapy has played in his life and in his writing. And Milo Miles reviews a recording of a 1963 concert by bluesman Bucca White. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Pat Conroy. His best-known novels include The Great Santini, about a Marine combat pilot who is an abusive father, and The Prince of Tides, about a man whose sister tries to commit suicide. After he meets her psychotherapist, he realizes how little he understands about himself. Conroy's new novel, Beach Music, is about a middle-aged man trying to get away from his family's past. His mother is a charmer who constantly rewrites the past to suit her needs. His father is a bully. In your novel, the father says to the main character, you know, you're just like me. And the main character thinks, I am not. How much do you think you resemble your father?
Like, it is perfectly hideous. My brothers and I talk about this all the time. When my mother was dying, we were all around her bed, and my brother Jim said something. He said, that sounded like Dad, didn't it? And we all said, it certainly did. And my brother Tim said to Jim, you're the most like Dad, the most of any of us. And he said, is that true, Pat? And I said, it certainly is, Jim. And he said, would one of you shoot me through the brain and put me out of my misery if this is true? Yet all of us know that we're very much like Dad. It drives me nuts that I'm so much like my father. It drives my brothers just simply crazy that we're so much like Dad. I mean, as we age, we look more like Dad. We walk like Dad. We talk like Dad.
But you never hit your family like your father.
Pardon me? No, I don't. But, you know, what I realize, even with that, that we realize later on, is that we may not hit, you know, our wives and children, but we're violent. I mean, we're violent men. We were raised in violence. And I couldn't figure out when I was very early in my first marriage, when a kid would knock over a glass of milk, why'd I want to hit him? And then what it was that's any kid that knocked over a glass of milk with Dad got hit. And so that's why the oldest kids, we as the oldest kids, had to sit at the by Dad so the young kids could be down the table where they would be out of his reach. And so what you don't know is you carry these things in you from your childhood without even knowing it. This is baggage you bring along the way. And this was a terrifying thought to all of us. But Dad lives deeply inside us, and there's nothing we can do about it except try to control it.
You seem to have so many insights into psychology, you know, how people work, what motivates them, and so on. And you've seen a psychiatrist yourself.
I have to say, a psychologist. Furious.
Okay.
She would be enraged.
No, in Prince of Tides, the main character's first real encounter with psychotherapy is when he goes to help his sister, who's in therapy. Did you have a similar experience of that? Was that an experience for you that was the first encounter with psychotherapy?
It was. I hit a time in the 1970s when my sister had a suicide attempt, and my mother called me up. This is another one of my mom stories. My mother called me up and said, your sister has tried to kill herself again. Try not to blame yourself.
Don't think elephant.
I said, Mom, I'll try very hard. So I haven't seen her for 2 years. This is going to be an easy one. And I said, when are you going? She said, I can't. We're having a party this weekend. And I said, yeah, you'd hate to miss a party. And so I ended up going up to Minneapolis, and this was my first encounter, you know, with this world, the world of mental hospitals, the world of therapists, and the world of suicide, which I would later get much, much more intimate with.
What were your first impressions of that world of therapy?
Well, she was in this terrible public mental hospital. This is, you know, like, you know, the cuckoo's nest, and it was horrible. What I learned up there, though, there were very nice people working for very little money in hospitals like that. And they seemed to have some, and this was before I think I was writing The Great Santini then and had just finished it. And it was when I was up there, you know, one thing I saw that there were people in much worse shape. There were people with much worse stories. But it got me interested in that thing of, how far the mind has to go before it breaks down completely.
So was it, did you feel like you learned a lot talking to your sister's therapist and watching their interaction?
Yeah, and I learned a lot, you know, more later of just trying to figure out, you know, I started asking questions about people in my life and I started looking around. And I realized that suicide has been, you know, a large part of my life. I've had, you know, friends, several friends have done this. I had a cousin to do it. I had a stepbrother do it. Now I have a brother that did it.
Does that bring the option of suicide closer because it's been a reality to
It certainly does. And it's certainly because I've thought about it myself and have considered it myself. You know, I think it's become, you know, such a vivid and personal part of my fiction.
My guest is Pat Conroy, author of The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, and the new novel Beach Music. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Pat Conroy. Do you think there's a chemical thing in your family, a chemical-based depression?
My father certainly hopes so. You know, when it comes to that, you know, whether it's the family that does it, environment, or whether it's chemistry, he certainly opts for chemistry. And I just don't know. It seems to me that something with my brother Tom was chemical. Something was that he could not stop, that he could... when he flipped, I want to tell you, it was like nothing you've ever seen.
This is the brother that killed himself?
Yes.
You were there?
Oh, yeah, I was there, you know, several times when I got, you know, we get a call from somebody saying Tom's gone off again. And many times he would simply disappear. And we found out later he was going off in the woods in the summer on a tropical island. And he would stay there for weeks. When he came back, he'd be covered with ticks, insect bites, hallucinating. And, you know, so I saw a lot of this firsthand.
Did you feel responsible for tracking him down and getting him out of trouble?
Well, you know, we always were afraid Tom would hurt himself or hurt someone else. You know, this was always a thing. Tom was a strong kid. And when he would, yet he was so sweet. You know, when he was at his funeral, my sister read a poem, but all I could remember during that whole day was, when he was 12, Tom asked to have a meeting with me. He went to have an official meeting. I was 27. So I sat down with him and I said, what's the meeting about? And he said, Pat, I'm 12 years old. I'm almost a man. And you're my little brother, but you got to quit calling me baby. And I said, you know, I'm so sorry, baby. He said, see? And I said, I know. And I said, Tom, I can explain why I do this. Is I call all... When the kids were born, they always were the baby. And I always go, like, get the baby. You know, we got to get the baby. Let's go upstairs with the baby. And grab the baby. And the baby was baby until the next kid was born. And I realized with you, there's never a next kid born. And that's why I call you baby. And he said, I understand that. But the reason for this meeting is I want you to be called Tom. So he shook my head. He says, my name's Tom. And it was that story I remembered all during his funeral. And I could think of nothing else.
Do you find psychotherapy useful for yourself? You know, this kind of insights into family or personality.
It has been extraordinarily useful and therapeutic for me. I use Marion O'Neill for this reason. It's fine tuning in my life. I like to go in there to see how my life is going. I'm not in desperate straits now like I was when I first went to her, but I like getting that eye that. Unrelenting eye that lets me know how I'm doing, if what I am doing is ethical, if it is, I am operating from a basis of loving and contributing to humanity and not being one of the nemesis of it. She holds me responsible for what I do, and I have found it personally to be a very valuable thing. And the reason I talk about it, Terry, is that there's so many men. In the country that seem to look at it is a mark of failure, is a mark of a collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it could help them very much.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about the editing process of the book. I know you wrote like 2,100 pages or something, and then in conjunction with your editor, Nantelise, edited it down to just a little over
10 pages.
A little over 10 pages, a short story now. It's a little over 600. So what was that process like of shortening it?
Well, Nana's been very good for me, just like my previous editor, Jonathan Glassy. Both of them have allowed me this. I tell them, let me let it all out. I like to write at full tide. And let me let it all go. And then I promise y'all, when we come to the editing thing, I'll be as rigorous as you are about cutting the book down. But if you'll let me just open it all up. And Nana's been very good about this. Jonathan was wonderful about this. And so I like to just let it fly. And what surprised me when I came up to New York to edit with Nan is it would take 4 months and that we would be trimming and cutting and trying to get the book in some semblance of shape. And I always tell them, I say, and I told Nan, I said, Nan, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you work, people will say it really needed editing. So I always love it when those reviews come in.
I've known writers who are afraid to talk through a book that they're writing because they're afraid that they'll tell it and that will make them unable to write it. And you're such a good storyteller, but are you careful about not telling stories that are going to be in your book?
I tell them all. There's so many things. There's so many fears about writing.
Mm-hmm.
Superstitions. There's so many superstitions, and you don't. And there's so many reasons you don't write. And there's so many. I have met writers who are terrified before they've written a book about what the critics will say. You know, they're talking about what critics will say years before the book is even in existence. I've seen writers worry about overwriting. Are desperate about it. That writers will only use one adjective in a sentence, and they will be very stingy with the language. Because this is a time it's. You know, I write in this florid, overblown, pretentious prose that, you know, friends of mine who are writers will, you know, tell me to tone it down. And I'll try to tone that down during the editing process. I try not to when I'm writing that first time.
Do you know what your next novel is going to be about?
Yeah, I think I'll write an Atlanta novel. I lived in Atlanta as an adult for much of my adult life, and I've always been interested in the way that city grows, and I've never written a city novel. And I think I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to go to Atlanta. It's a place where I was born, where my mother grew up. My grandmother first got a job at Rich's Department Store. I don't know how much of a family thing it's going to be. It might be my first novel of friends, the people that have been important to me as an adult.
Are you looking forward to starting a new book, or are you dreading it?
No, I look forward to this one. I dreaded Beach Music, and the reason is because of the success of The Prince of Tides. I simply did not know how to follow that. I did not know what to do about that, and it terrified me. And, you know, I had never had Hoopla in my life, and, you know, then I had it. Even when I was dealing with Barbra Streisand with The Prince of Tides in the movie, I had never dealt with somebody that famous, and because I was hanging around her, her aura rubbed off on me. And so all of this worried me, upset me, and made it much harder to go to the writing desk again.
But you think that's behind you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, now, you know, whatever happens to this is I'm not following The Prince of Tides.
Is there a movie in the works for Beach Music?
They, Paramount bought it last Friday. And Alan Ladd Jr. is going to do it for Paramount.
So do you know who's going to be in it?
You know, they always talk. Right? I always feel like I'm lying. Anytime I quote Hollywood, I feel like, you know, I'm lying. Yeah. And it always turns out not to be. This happened the first time when The Great Santini came out. They told me George C. Scott was going to be in it. I went on television in South Carolina announcing George C. Scott was in it. And then they had to print a retraction the next week because George C. Scott had never heard of it. But I don't know who will be in it to answer that question.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very, very much for talking with us.
It has been an absolute pleasure, Tim.
Pat Conroy, his new novel is called Beach Music. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams in Washington with a word about all things considered coming up. Mickey Cantor, U.S. Trade Representative, announces that his office will go ahead with an investigation of the Japanese film market. Is it unfair to Kodak products? Other stories, Linda Gradstein has a report on life in Gaza for Palestinians after the Israeli troops left a year ago. Margot Adler reports on the incidence of AIDS within the artistic community in New York. A report on the 150th anniversary of Henry David Thoreau's moving to Walden Pond. And I'll talk with a documentary filmmaker about the life and career of George Seldes, who has died at age 104. He was a reporter and a press critic. That and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Perhaps more than any other performers, country blues masters are surrounded by the rosy glow of myth and memory. Reputations of performers from the 30s and 40s are sometimes built on very thin support, and even major figures can sound different than their legends, if just as profound. Commentator Milo Miles has his ups and downs with one of the greats of Delta blues, Buckle White, but now Milo has heard a record that fully redeems White's second career that began in 1963.
Booker T. White was an older cousin of B.B. King's. He was called Bucca because some northerner couldn't understand his Mississippi accent and put his records out under that name. He has also done what I consider the best job of describing the state of mind necessary to write the blues. He recommended being about half worried and half joyous. White was one of the key rediscovered country bluesmen of the 1960s, but sad to say, until now, I've always felt you had to be there to appreciate his later years. Now, his early years, the late 1930s and early 40s, were something else. White recorded just before, during, and just after serving a manslaughter sentence in the notorious Parchman Farm prison in Mississippi. The intensity of these sides has led to comparisons with the work of Robert Johnson, but that seems glib to me. Bucca White's blues are not as brooding or casually mysterious as Johnson's. What they were was incredibly vivid, jumping with detail about prison life, hopping trains, getting on and laying down to die. This is perhaps the most celebrated number from those days.
I'm looking fun in my eyes now. Believe I'm fixing to die. Believe I'm fixing to die. I'm looking fun in my eyes now. Believe I'm fixing to die. I know I was born to die, but I ain't leave my children crying.
By the time White came out of semi-retirement to begin playing for white college crowds, a lake full of gin had washed over his vocal cords, and he could no longer quite pull off the eerie quaver that decorated his early singing. Also, his repertoire had changed, and he did not benefit from the freedom to record tunes that went on as long as he wanted. He claimed that he could make up entire blues on the spot, pull them out of the sky, and he sure could, but he never claimed they'd be coherent and concise, and boy, they often weren't. At least that was true of the performances I had heard before the recently released concert recording, 1963 Isn't 1962. This performance proved that White had not just become a different, more mundane blues man since the 40s. He was still grand. There are only two extended tracks, and the updated Train Blues Streamline Special was apparently always played the same way. The title number is an improvised blues with the kind of brio and momentum White seldom managed in such songs. And the rest is a mix of fervent remakes of his old material and some expertly selected new styles that he bends to his will. For instance, he just overwhelms Charles Brown's Driftin' Blues, and you'd never suspect the original was a smooth piano croon. ¶¶
so long. I'm gonna tell you right now, baby, no need to wring your little hands and cry. I'm gonna start to tell you walking away from you, baby, so long, so long.
Bucca White surely saw his share of hard times working in factories and as a boxer. He was a truly tough guy with a tender heart who made his way without apology. A notable plus of 1963 isn't 1962 are the vibrant, well-written liner notes by David Evans. He evokes the era when members of the white middle class ran across country blues and then had a chance to hobnob with their idols. The college boys expected to meet folk gurus from another world, but instead met black people who had very much lived in this world. And no one can say that wasn't the best possible enlightenment.
Milo Miles is a music critic based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed the Bucca White concert recording, 1963 Isn't 1962.
You can talk just about your plan, but I ain't gonna never bury get away your trip on me.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, I want to tell you, if it's tried in 63, I bet you the undertaker baby will take care of you. I told you last year, 63 won't be like 62. Baby, do you remember him tell you last year? 63 never be like 62. I done talked it over down in Texas and told him what's going on. Try it into 63, baby. Somebody gonna trick you. One night, late at night, sent a dim light blinding through my window blind. Late one night, I just stayed out to see where my baby was going. I eased up to one of them old window blind, red and where she was. Down on a pole, had been in the east, screaming, crying.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional funding comes from Farrer, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.